Hi, this is Dr. Linda Papadopoulos with the Psychology Behind. Now, this week I got to speak to Stuart Semple. Stuart is an award-winning artist, and he's absolutely brilliant. He's also a mental health campaigner, and he shares with me on this podcast his own experience of struggling with his own mental health and trying to find the best therapy for him, kind of taking responsibility for his own care, which is fascinating. His art speaks to a lot of the disconnectedness that we feel, but also I think to the hope of a shared understanding of that need for connectedness in life. I enjoyed speaking to him so much, and I really hope you enjoyed too. I give you Stuart Semple. I'm sitting here today with Stuart Semple. Stuart is an artist and an ambassador for the mental health charity Mind. He has done some truly amazing work that we'll speak about. He's initiated creative therapies throughout Wales and England. He's had some of the most, in my opinion, thought-provoking, powerful installations, both in the US and here. And I'm delighted to have him on the podcast. Stuart, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Now, there's so much I want to speak to you, but I think let's start with art. I'm a huge fan of art. I any piece that I have at home is, they probably completely mismatched or whatever, but it's just always been something that moved me, and I kind of feel is good for the soul. And I can't quite put my finger on what it is about the power of it, but I think, I guess, the act is like Rorschach. You know those ink blots they do in psychology? So every time I look at it, depending on how I feel, I see something different. Because I see something different, it somehow allows me to tweak my perspective. And I think that's the power personally for me. Tell me about you and art. What drew you to it?
Well, there's lots of things. Let me speak to the first point, which is that you're saying it's almost like a Rorschach kind of test. Well, there's two parts to an artwork. There's the artwork and then there's the viewer. So I believe an artwork's not actually finished until a human being stands in front of it. So you're kind of finishing that story off, which is a beautiful thing, which is why art speaks to you and why art works. I mean, art is a deeply personal and emotional thing. It shows us what human beings felt, what human beings have been through. And I think we have a resonance to that.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think just growing up, I was always just amazed by art. It touched me from the first time I saw it. When I was 8 years old, I saw a Van Gogh at the National Portrait Gallery. It just blew my head off. It's all I kind of wanted to do. And then in later life, as things changed for me, particularly through my teenage years, when I started to struggle with various mental health issues, art became sort of be-all and end-all for me. It became kind of the only thing that kind of made sense. And it took on a whole new meaning, actually.
This is very interesting, because I think that there is something about that transition into the teenage years. And I don't know whether it is about identity or our ability to understand and express our own emotions. And I think having an outlet at that point, whether it is, whatever it is, music, writing, art, is profoundly important. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Van Gogh. I've got to say, every time I look at his work, I'm a huge fan. I kind of think this man struggled so much, yet the color always gets me, right? The vibe, it's this juxtaposition between, I think, pain and hope. Or pain of what life is and what it could be. How I'd be interested to see what you see in it.
My take on it is that they're very joyous paintings. He's at his best when he's painting. You know, no matter how troubled he is, in his art, he's so alive. And it's just powerful work, isn't it?
It really is. There's a theory in psychology around people almost being able to produce their best art when they're in some sort of emotional turmoil. Is this something that you believe?
I'm shy of that cliche. You know, I don't think we have to all be suffering to make great stuff.
Uh-huh.
But there's no doubt that great work has come from suffering. And when we connect with work that comes from that place as a viewer, maybe we don't have to go to that place ourselves. So the artists can step to the edge of things and feel that on our behalf. So maybe we don't have to go there. And that's kind of why work can give us sort of solace in some ways.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned what your struggles with your own mental health began around your teenage years. Can you talk me through that?
I think probably I struggled with anxiety for a long time and I didn't realise what it was. I think I was a very shy kid. I used to hide in my room and listen to music and draw. I was quite an isolated character. Then I moved away to university and I went to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, which is about as far away from home as you could possibly get. And I felt homesickness. I felt what it felt to be alone for the first time and not really know who I was. I was left in the middle of a field in Yorkshire, not knowing anybody and not really knowing myself. And I think that was the background for kind of what went wrong. And I started to have what I now know are panic attacks, but I didn't really know what they were. And this is going back 20 odd years, so I don't think the people around me even knew what they were. Anyway, I went through that and I was travelling back to visit my family, and I always had this idea that if I travelled home, something bad would happen. And I bought a sandwich from a motorway service station and I was allergic to it. And I turned up on my mum's doorstep, essentially dying from this allergy. I sort of flopped there, I hadn't seen her for 6 months. She took me to hospital, and after a period of time in the hospital, it became clear that they couldn't actually make me better. And the doctor came around and said, it's a matter of when, not if, and I've asked your family to come in. And, you know, so I sort of said my goodbyes to them. And they decided that they were going to try this radical thing. They were going to inject me with this plasma they got from another hospital. And I was allergic to the plasma.
Oh, my
goodness. So about 2 a.m, I flatlined. I died. I came back and everything was different. It just literally blew the top of my head off. I left the hospital with what then became an intense psychological problem across eating, sort of almost like a PTSD from the trauma, and what became a sort of OCD type obsession with bodily processes and my own health that lasted nearly 20 years. And, and I'm here now, sort of 6 months ago, I felt like I was better. So this has been on for most of my adult life. It's been really tough.
I can imagine. And I think, again, it's one thing you having gone through this, you know, now, but 20 years ago, when not only is not the general kind of population very psychologically minded, even medics, not so. So the notion of having a health-related sort of PTSD or health-related OCD, which would have been just, just completely...
And the confusing thing actually about sort of panic disorder is it can present in a very physical way, and it can look like an allergy. I'm struggling to swallow. I can't take my breath. My heart rate's up. They're going to treat you at the emergency room as if you're having an allergy. So I was calling the ambulance every other night thinking I was dying of allergies all the time.
And of course you would have been much more sensitized to bodily changes because you literally, you know, almost, well, you did die, you know, you flatline. So of course you're going to be hyper aware of any bodily changes.
Totally.
And if you don't have any psychological support to be able to not only distinguish between one and the other, but to look at probability versus possibility.
Absolutely.
Had that right in the beginning, it would have at least given you some tools, which would have definitely shortened it.
Yeah, but the frustrating thing was they send a kid out who's died back to what? Like no support at all, absolutely nothing for me. And it took me probably a decade to even work out it was a psychological thing and not a bodily thing.
So
I went on this huge crusade to understand everything I possibly could about it.
And how did you get them? Because again, we're talking, this was years ago, right? So Google wasn't what it is today.
Google wasn't what it is. And even today, I don't trust half of it, which is the problem, especially if you have health anxiety. You can diagnose yourself with everything going. which I used to do till 3 or 4 in the morning. I've been through a crazy whirlwind of stuff. Different therapies, psychotherapy, CBT, shamanic healing rituals, yogic retreats, strange meditation practices, naturopathic medicine, all sorts of different stuff. And I think I've kind of come to a place where I found kind of what works for me. And I think it's interesting. I think we're all as sort of unique as our fingerprint. And I think actually our own wellness, when we take it on as our own responsibility, we actually start to find things that work. And biological things have helped. I mean, food's helped. Sleep's been a major one. Breathing, being able to connect with my body in a different way, all these things have been so transformative for me.
Do you know what's true? I again in my clinical practice and you know, in my research, one of the things that I always think we forget, so Maslow has this hierarchy of needs, and right at the top is self-actualization, being this person we're supposed to be. But right at the bottom, the biggest part of this triangle is, are you feeding your body? Is it sleeping enough? We know that sleep deprivation feeds into depression and mood. Of course it does. It's not just the other way around. You know, are you moving? You know, we know the biochemistry of happiness. And we know that one of those chemicals, endorphins, is absolutely part of your body functioning well. And also, are you in tune with your body? You know, we speak about this in campaigns, or we talk about, you know, checking your breasts, and rightly so. We say, know what your body feels like so you can see a difference. Well, taking your own temperature psychologically as well is very important. And I love this idea of kind of taking responsibility for our own individual wellness.
Yeah, it's quite a controversial one, but I think for me, the realization came when it was like, it's on me, you know, it's me, and no one's coming to save me. There's no boat over the horizon that's gonna fix this. If you want to get well, it's you, it's on you. And that was a hugely empowering thing and a hugely terrifying thing. But what I've started to realize is actually it's possible to fully recover. It takes work and effort, but you can do it. I mean, I'm here, I'm well enough, I got the train, I'm sat here. This would not have happened 6 months ago. So it's possible, this is doable.
Yeah, and that is such an important message for people to hear, because I think when you're processing feelings, right, you're processing them in that moment, right? So if you and I are scared or anxious now, the ability to project forward is unbelievably hard, because of course I'm focusing on this intense, whatever it is, anxiety, fear, you know, stress, and just knowing that what I'm feeling now is not necessarily going to be what I'm feeling even in 2 hours, right? I think that's what this postponement of or this ability not to kind of paint my whole world or my whole being with this one moment is key. But even that's a learning process, is it not?
It's
right?
It's tough. And also, like, a lot of the advice, a lot of the therapists I saw, you know, they were telling me the best we can do is teach you how to cope with this. You know, and that to me was like a life sentence. And I was like, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying that I can't be better, because when I'm on an aeroplane and I'm freaking out, the rest of the people behind me aren't. So this is possible. You know, if I'm lying on the floor at the end of yoga and I'm having a panic attack, other people in the room aren't. So I was like, no, I just don't buy this. You know, I'm made of the same stuff. I think I can get better.
Yeah, it's amazing. So when you begin to start, you know, to talk about this, because one of the things that I've kind of beating my drum for many years now is the difference with which we spoke about physical illness and mental health. So you are entitled to for your arm to hurt and to have a cold and for your, you know, ears to have an infection. But, you know, mental illness, are you reading this right? Are you sure? Are you maybe just kind of overreacting? So the sense of entitlement to ask for space, to ask for support, to ask for help, was something that was a long time coming.
Yeah,
tell
for
me
sure.
For you, where do you find, because to me, I'm sitting here outside going, he's freaking strong, right? To be able to, where did you find that? No, I will ask for this. I will speak about this, because you've been beating a drum on this for a while too.
Yeah, for a long time. And I've seen huge things change, particularly what we've done with Mind. When I first started working with Mind as an ambassador, it wasn't like it is today. Actually, today when we're recording this, it's Time to Talk Day.
Yeah.
And that's massive. And we're seeing all celebrities all over the world posting tweets about how they feel. We'd have never seen that. Mm-hmm. So we're in an amazing place now.
Yeah.
But there are problems that come with that. Huge problems. And I, you know, it's controversial to say it, but I'm confused about that, because we're telling people to speak up about their mental health and explain what they're going through. And we're more accepting and open to that.
Yeah.
But the services aren't there. At the end, you know, what door are they knocking on if they're not getting the support they need? And the other thing is, I'm really concerned about glamorous looking celebrities talking about their mental health on social media, because I think maybe kids want to be like celebrities. You'll see them queue around the block for a new pair of Kanye sneakers. I don't want it to be something that's desirable.
Do you know what this is? It's such an interesting point, because, and it's something that I've spoken about with other guests on the podcast before, I think part of me is absolutely delighted that it's in the general public and we're talking about, and you see people that are very successful and think, well, absolutely. But I think, and I don't, maybe this is controversial, I think it shouldn't become a bandwagon for people to jump on. And I don't think people are doing it in a disingenuous way necessarily, but I think there is something important about, I don't want mental health to become minimalized, right?
Sure.
So there's something qualitatively different between I'm stressed and I'm having a full-blown panic attack. Now, it's not to kind of say that stress feels great and I think you should have a handle on it, but I think we need to make the right type of space and support for something that is a genuine illness.
Absolutely. And I think you're totally right. It's the same with the difference between intolerances and allergies. Because you know, being someone who suffers from allergies and could die in a restaurant or on an airplane, I also have friends who are intolerant to like glucose and wheat or whatever. It makes them a bit bloated and it's not very fun, but they're not going to drop dead. And I think there's general stress. We live in a stressful society, yeah. Right? That's getting worse and worse and worse. And our bodies and our minds and our chemistry are trying to adapt to this environment that we're in.
Yeah.
And perfectly natural. And our bodies and minds are doing the best job they can.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, some people are really, really struggling. And I think there needs to be a differentiation in some ways.
Exactly. Because if everyone has something, in a way, no one has something. Do you know what I mean? If everyone has this issue, then is it still an issue? So sure. I think we need to be speaking about it in a much more delicate and nuanced way in terms of quantitative difference, of course, but also in terms of qualitative difference, because these exist as well. So then the question becomes, right, how do we talk about it, Stuart? Like, how, you know, do we have to talk about it long form, or do those small posts help? Like, what do you think?
I think it helps. I think the conversation helps.
Yeah.
But I think there's a whole variety of things that we could actually be doing about it.
Yeah.
So I think talking about something's great, but doing about something's even better.
Yeah.
So we can actually take action on stuff. So we can actually start to look at, what does wellness look like? What are the pieces of the puzzle that make us well and happy? And what would a diet of wellness be?
Yeah.
And maybe that's what we need to encourage. And maybe we don't reserve that just for the people who are really struggling. But actually, if you're doing all right at the moment, awesome. How can we help you do even better?
Yeah.
If you're backsliding a bit, how can we get you back on track quickly? And if you're in crisis, now what do you need?
Yeah.
And it's across that whole spectrum.
You raise a really interesting point about well-being, because, and I think my profession has something to answer for this, because psychologists, what do? We kind of, you know, want to get people who are unwell to feel better, but we don't want to get people that are just okay to feel well, if you know what I mean. So if there's a spectrum of unwell and a spectrum of feeling great, then we only kind of ever try and get people to just like, okay, you're in the middle, and
right,
maybe there's something about, well, how do I, you know,
yeah, like, you know, or let's get you back to where you were before this happened.
Yeah.
No, how awesome could your life be? Let's aim for that.
Yeah
Let's aim for great.
Let's aim for great. And also, again, let's not kind of cartoonify and caricaturize what great is, because happiness is not a state that you reach and there, I'm happy now. That's not how it works. It's captured in a moment. And in between that, I think instead of conceptualizing problems as these insurmountable mountains, which if you have a mental health issue will often feel like that. I've sat across from people who have told me washing the dishes is no different than running a marathon when I'm depressed.
Sure.
And I can, you know, it feels like that. But, you know, so let's start conceptualizing difficulties as problems you solve. And then you have those moments of, you know, of wonderfulness that you hold on to that nourish you. And then, yeah, it's like you said earlier, what does a diet look like? What is your emotional five a day, right?
Yeah, totally.
What are your fruits and vegetables that you can do for your mind?
And I think in my own experience, I tested it on myself. I experimented on myself for 20 years and I found the ingredients of what that was for me. And that might not work for someone else listening.
Sure.
But it's about finding that.
What is, if you don't mind me asking, what are your kind of things that kind of get you through? What are the non-negotiables?
Non-negotiables. I think understanding the connection my breath has to my body is phenomenal. Like, and there's been so much research into this idea of balanced breathing.
Oh, explain that. Just
and
tell me a bit about
that. Yeah, I mean, it's massive. I mean, there was a study a couple of weeks ago in some big New York kind of like medical journal about it. But yogis have known it for like 5,000 years. Basically, when you're anxious, you breathe in a certain pattern. You know, you breathe from the top of your chest, you breathe shallow breathing, etc. When you're relaxed, you take longer, slower, deeper breaths. It's more abdominal. We understand that. But what we're starting to find is the length of time between the in-breath and out-breath is important. And what yoga will teach you is to breathe in through your left nostril, out through your right nostril, in through your right nostril, out through your left nostril. What this does is it balances the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. Proven. Thousands of blind studies. You can control what your body is doing through your breath. It is a doorway into what's happening. Your body is a chemistry lab. The best one ever made. And you can control it with your mind and you can control it with your breath. So it sounds stupid because it is so simple. But by getting a handle on your breath, making that out breath longer than the in breath, it's totally transformative. Now I'm up to 10 seconds in, 20 seconds out. I do it every morning. The longer this breath is getting, the lower my anxiety seems to be in my life. It's
phenomenal.
Mind blowing.
Wow.
Other things, sounds a bit kooky, but some supplements really help me. Magnesium, B6. Yeah. And it's a bit controversial, but cannabis oil has absolutely changed my life.
Wow. Well, and for you, looking at this stuff, how have the people around you responded? Who have been your kind of, how did your family, how did your friends tell when you were kind of on this journey? How important were they to getting you to where you are today?
They were supportive, but a big thing for me was I didn't want to reach out to them for reassurance.
Okay.
Initially, yes, in terms of crisis, but I didn't want to use them as some sort of crutch that sort of perpetuated what I was going through.
Interesting, okay.
Because
that
was one of my behaviours, actually. If I was freaking out, I'd look for reassurance from the outside world.
Right.
So I decided the mission was mine, and I had to work it out for myself.
And isn't there something so profound about doing the uncomfortable, right? So, you know, it's a cliche because it's true. You know, the only way to increase confidence, to grow, whatever you want to call it, is to do the thing that you thought you couldn't do, right?
Absolutely.
And it sounds that's precisely what you did. You know, the thing that felt the most, not necessarily counterintuitive, but most difficult is this thing that you were like, well, this is what I need to conquer.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And that's how you grow, isn't it? I mean, through challenging yourself.
It's the only way. And I guess it's, you know, for me, the kind of looking at trends in mental health, and we're kind of finding that, oh, you know, there's these issues around millennials and younger people. I think one of the problems as parents and I think it came from a very good place, was this idea of removing obstacles. So I love this kid. I want to make its life wonderful. So any op, you don't like your French teacher, we'll get rid of, you know, we'll find out, you know, you're not happy about not getting a medal, so we'll get you a medal in sports, say whether you did well or not. And I think there's something really important about making a child feel like a bouncy ball and not a vase. So when you fall down, you bounce back up and you don't shatter. And that, again, is a learned response, is it not? To a large extent.
And also an over-obsession with perfection.
Oh.
You know, I think it's totally unrealistic. We can't be perfect all the time. Everything's not always going to go right. And it's just about accepting the rough with the smooth, you know. That's what life is. And we're in such a stressful culture, society, time, you know, across the media, imagery, social media, everything. And we're only, you know, we haven't caught up. I don't think biologically or psychologically we've caught up with the world we're in. And we're an adaptive species, the most adaptive. You put us in the middle of the desert, we'll thrive. You put us in freezing cold conditions, right, we'll work it out.
Yeah.
But I just don't think we've quite adjusted. It's happening too quickly.
Yeah. There's this really interesting thing that I was looking at the other day. So basically, there's something called ultimate penetration. And it's when the use of something in a society reaches 50 million. So the radio, I think, to reach ultimate penetration was something like 38 years. And the TV was in the 20 some odd years. And then the fax machine was like, I don't know, 10 or 12 years. Do you know how long it took Angry Birds to reach ultimate penetration?
No.
35 days.
Whoa. Yeah, so, that says it all.
Yeah, I think in the region. So you're absolutely right. So we have our social evolution and then we have our technological evolution and the mismatch between the two. I mean, think about it. You know, we had hundreds of thousands of years where communication, you know, wasn't even, you know, verbal, and communication from afar was like smoke signals and drums. And then we speak. And then now all of a sudden we have to kind of figure out what damn emojis mean. Like, you know, so it's like, or kind of show empathy via an emoji.
Sure.
And that isn't easy. That's not something that's, you know, innate.
No. And I think, you know, ultimately we are social creatures. Community is really, really important, and a lot of the art projects I've been doing around the world actually deal with the idea of community and connection and actually bringing people together, particularly strangers, in public spaces.
Yeah.
I think that's so important. I think it's vital, actually, because I think we're becoming more and more atomized and more isolated, and I think the two things go hand in hand. It's like the perfect storm, actually, for problems.
I couldn't agree more. I think, and not to get too kind of political about this, but I think one of my biggest worries is that if you and I were having a discussion even 5 years ago, you could probably bet that you and I were reading sort of similar books and, you know, watching similar newscasts. I think these days you and I could be talking about the same thing, but because we're curating the information that we engage with to such an extent, you could be looking at something as green and I'm looking at it as purple, and I could be adamant that you're looking at it in a different way. And I think that explains a heck of a lot when we look at this disenfranchisement and politics, what's going on. And it scares me, because I do think humanity really does depend on the conversations we have. I think that's all we bloody have. I don't think we have much more than that. And when we are only talking with people that think like us and tweet like us and speak like us and vilifying.
For sure.
So I should be able to have a conversation with you, even if we don't agree, and get to a point of not kind of seeing each other's views point, you know, completely, at least me accepting that you're allowed to have yours, where I kind of look around at what our politics is descending into and what our conversations, and it genuinely, Stuart, it worries me. From your point of view, as someone who I feel that we're in sort of the same line of work, right? It's kind of social commentary to some extent. So whether you're a psychologist looking at trends or an artist, is this something that you see or that worries you?
Yeah. Quite simply, yeah. I mean, everything you said, for sure.
How do you build bridges? How do you?
Well, I think, you know, personally, through my art. So that makes sense to me. And one of the things that I found works massively, actually, that listeners can do, is volunteer somewhere, go and help, go out, work at the local food bank, go and help at the homeless shelter, whatever rocks your boat, go to the dog's home, and realise that there are people out there worse off than you. It puts everything in perspective. No matter how bad you got it, there's someone who's got it worse. Yeah. And that's major. For me, I want my art to be useful, because I think art's important. And luckily, as artists, we're now free from having to make pretty pictures or things that look like other things. We can actually use art to perform social functions. So, for instance, one of the ones I made recently was an emotional baggage drop, which I installed in the main train station in Denver for a month, where two strangers would enter this box, almost like a sort of secular confessional, and they were invited to share something with a stranger who would then hear them and then in return share something that they were struggling with. And it was phenomenal. Like, the results of that were huge, and we did a big social study around that. With a guy who wrote a fantastic book called Happy City, and he did a lot of data and a study around that piece of work. And what we found is that when strangers come together and share something emotional, they're more likely to do loads of really cool stuff, like believe if they lost their wallet, someone would hand it in. More likely to trust a stranger, etc., etc.
Well, it reinstills your faith in humanity,
it
doesn't it?
Because
you connect. There's been some fascinating research even on dating, where you kind of get people to simply, very simply, look at each other in the eye without talking, and then share a personal anecdote for a couple of minutes. And the intense emotional connection that's felt and the positivity about the future of that relationship is off the charts.
Yeah.
And I think it's because, you know, it's the biggest irony of our time. We're more connected yet disconnected than ever before. And
totally.
And that's what we have to, I mean, again, in Denver, one of your beautiful installation, it's well, you described it too, but yeah, the smile.
It's, I'll describe it. It's a giant smiley face. It's a bit like a stress ball that's been squished in an alleyway between two buildings. And it's called I Should Be Crying, But I Just Can't Let It Show.
I saw that, and I literally, I showed it to so many. I mean, how profound, I think, is on it. Yeah, that was, and when was that installed?
It was installed about 6 months ago, but I just heard from them a couple of weeks ago, and they want to make it permanent, which is amazing.
Congratulations.
Yes,
that's
I'm so happy,
amazing.
Like, people have really responded to it, and the city want to keep it.
You've got to make
so
one
cool.
In London. I saw, again, your bubble smileys in London. That can be described, if you don't mind that one, this one's amazing.
It's a modified snow machine that makes artificial clouds. So it pumps the sky full of smiley-faced, eco-friendly clouds. And at the height of the recession, when it was really the doom and gloom and the credit crunch, it was terrible. I released these from Tate Modern, and they blew towards the financial district, thousands of them. So these big, like, smiley-faced foam clouds.
And again, just getting people to look up, right? To look up and not be hunched over, and to kind of see. It's interesting, we were speaking just before we started speaking about the podcast that we both love water, right?
Yeah.
And there's something about this idea of just even engaging with your environment, Stuart. I think that, and that, I love that's a big part of what your art does, that it's out there. It's kind of like this, I'm going to say Taoist, but it's kind of, it's there, it makes sense, you know, for where it is.
Yeah.
It
doesn't feel, yeah. I mean, you don't kind of want to get too spiritual about it, maybe, but it brings people into the present moment. Because, and together, if two people look at a piece of art together, they're both in that moment together, connecting through something. And that's why the theatre's great and ballet's great.
Yeah,
well, you know, that's what the arts do.
Yeah, it is. It is what the arts do. I think they shine a lens. They bring people together. And I think there are a lot. I think you guys can say stuff that others can't, right? I think that there's something about the bravery of it. I think many other professions are just they're just not as brave. I think not able to be.
Well, we're so lucky. You know, we're not censored in that way. I mean, people expect our artists to speak out and do all the weird and wonderful stuff. So there's so much freedom. We've got a whole history of people doing really out there stuff as artists. So there's a massive amount of freedom to express whatever you want.
One of the things I always do when I end the podcast is to ask people three questions about really sort of significant things in their life. One is a moment, and it was a moment that was an aha moment for you, where you kind of thought, okay, this is profound, and it kind of maybe changed the course of your life or shed some light on how you saw something. The second is a comfort, so your go-to thing when things are feeling a bit, and I know you've kind of, you might touch on what we already touched on, that's fine, we spoke
no
about.
No, yeah.
And the third is a compass, sort of how you orientate yourself to your next challenge. So how do you, if you're on your map and you know where you are, how do you know where you're going and where are you going next? So if we start with the moment.
I'll deal with one that happened about 6 months ago, because I think it's the point where I really felt like I was better, like I could say I was better. And I hadn't been back to London for about 10 years and since I moved away to the coast. And I came up to London and I visited where my old art studio was and the old street and the old buzzer. And I just took a walk for about an hour, hour and a half on my own. And visited all the things. They'd all changed. Everything looked different. Things had grown. But there was something that hadn't changed. And I found a part of me that has never changed. And has always been there.
Wow.
And just put everything into context. I'm not my mind. I'm not my body. And there's part of me that's not going anywhere.
And tell me about your comfort. What is... I know you've told me about
it. Like cooking this dish out of lentils and rice that my grandmother used to make, because she grew up in India and she taught me how to make it, and it's comfort food.
Yum! Oh, that sounds delicious. I love that. What's it called?
It's called khichdi.
Khichdi. So, is it what kind of spices are in it? What's it?
Very few. Yeah. Very few. Turmeric, a little bit of cumin.
Yeah, because we have one in Cyprus that I love. That's made out of lentils and rice as
well. Wow.
Yeah. And it's just delicious, and it's very much. It's just cozy and comforting.
Yeah.
And it's one of my. In fact, on my wedding day, when my mother was like, you know, when you're getting ready, it was in the evening. She's like, "What do you want?" And I was like, "I want that food because it's like my most."
But you know, a really interesting thing about it, if you mix the lentils and rice together, they each have different amino acids, and when you put lentils and rice together, it makes a complete protein.
No way!
Yeah, so I only just realised this, but yogis could live for like months and months on end just eating this, because it's a complete food. So that's a good tip for vegans.
Well, there we go, another protein. And finally, your compass or your challenge, that kind of what orientates you to your goals, or what's next?
How I do it is I stand there in the present moment, I take a deep breath, I put my hands on my heart, I close my eyes, and I picture where I want to go, and I see how that feels at a very bodily level. And it either feels right or it doesn't feel right.
Oh. Do you know who I used to say something very similar was Steve Jobs. He used to say he looked at himself in the morning, every mirror, and say, "This is where I'm going." And if it didn't feel right for more than, I think he said, 5 or 6 mornings in a row, he'd be like, "I'm probably going the wrong way."
Wow, did he?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know what? Again, I think it's taking your own temperature, you know,
totally.
Mentally cycle. Take your own temperature. You know, this idea that, you know, you're going to get like this big, you know, thing fall in your lap and like, "Hey, you've got to do this." Well, you need to look for it. You know, you need to stop, stand still. How am I genuinely feeling about this? Where am I?
Because we're so disconnected. I mean, how often do we actually check into our emotions and actually see what they are? Like, and I mean, clearly see what they are, not with some sort of overlay of what we think they might be meaning, but really what are they?
Stuart, I could speak to you forever. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
It was a brilliant chat. No, thank you for coming. And it's a real pleasure and honor.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Wow, that was a brilliant discussion. Again, I can't tell you guys how much I love doing these podcasts because I feel I learn so much from everyone that I speak to. And I think from Stuart's point of view, he has such a deep knowledge that comes from a place of I think necessity. He had to learn for himself. And I think because of that, you know, because of that kind of taking responsibility for understanding and learning about his condition, what was available to him, I think he speaks with amazing insight. I really hope you enjoyed that. If you did, you know the drill, subscribe, rate, let me know what you think. But also, if there's anyone that you think I should be speaking to that's inspired you in terms of how they've coped with their own challenges and their own health, physical or mental, then do let me know. I always love to hear from you. Until we meet next time, I wish you a very healthy and happy body and mind.